On Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA, it is WRTA Weekend. Doug Harrington with us once again, the one and only Dr. Gabe Merkin. Dr. Merkin, hello.
Hello, everybody.
Hey there. And the first thing we can just dismiss with, because we've sort of talked about it a great deal, wear the sunblock if you're going to be out, please.
That's correct. Skin cancer is almost exclusively excess sun exposure. And it's damage to your nuclear DNA from ultraviolet rays from the sun. So be careful.
All right. And we have a couple of emails that we'll start with here. And this is Ken in Maryland. Fitness rings. Have you tried any? What do you think of them? Do you use any health monitoring devices? Do you think they're more trouble, such as indicating false alarms, and might not be worth it? What is a fitness ring? Oh, you mean on your hand?
Sure, it's a ring you put on your hand. It's very nice because it's easy to carry. You don't have to have a larger monitor. The problem is you have nothing to see. So the ring can't give you changes that you need. So you should not and cannot depend on a fitness ring to monitor exercise routines. In other words, you can't use it to tell you how fast you're going. It takes you, so you can't see it on a monitor. And that's the biggest negative. You can't use it during exercise, but it is valuable. And the incredible thing is one fitness ring has a battery that'll last 12 days. Whereas all the other monitors, the longest they'll last is one day, if that long.
And, you know, I feel like an idiot because I asked you the question again. I was saying, fitness rings, that go on your hand. I didn't get that right away. But, I mean,
your finger.
Yeah, they go on your finger.
It's a ring.
Yeah, it sends information to your phone, I guess?
No, it can pick up the circulation. It does very well. And so it can tell you a lot of things, but it can't tell you the changes because you can't see it, so it takes a while. So any changes that are happening very fast can't be measured quickly on a fitness ring. And that's the biggest concern. But they're good for sleep monitoring. A fitness ring will measure you the light, deep, and the so-called REM sleep. So you can tell that if you stop breathing, it tells you how you're moving at night. If you stop moving, your fitness ring can wake you up and tell you that. You can use it to count your steps, like you hear this 1,000 steps, which has now been discredited as needing 1,000 steps to be each day to be healthy. But you can't, and you can get by on 500 steps and so forth. But you can use it to count steps. It can give you the calories burned. So it has advantages, but you're better off with a heart rate monitor if you want to use it for exercise.
As far as those 1,000 steps a day, does that have to be deliberate? Because I know a couple, some friends of mine, that are running after a 5-year-old, a dog, and a cat, and working at the same time. So I have to wonder, are they getting their 1,000 or 500 steps a day just for their usual activity?
No, the 1,000 steps is discredited because it certainly has. It's not just the number of steps, it's the intensity that you move about. But the message is that we're now finding that if you measure people and just want to see if they pick up the pace by washing their own dishes, mowing their own lawn, they have no exercise program at all, they don't need 1,000 steps. The people who just pick up the pace during the day do better. So we can tell you, you will prolong your life by doing 500 steps, not 10,000. 500 steps can even help you. Anything more than lying in bed and doing nothing is helpful. So the negative about 10,000 steps is that people say, I can't do 10,000 steps like you're doing. Everybody should know that if you do 500 steps, that's better than doing no steps. All activity that increases your heart rate is beneficial and life prolonging.
Interesting to think about. Well, I know as far as this, I used to mow the lawn from my dad when they lived in the same town after they moved back to Pennsylvania. And as a lot of times he would do it before I could get there because he figured, well, he'd rather do it than me. And he lived to be almost 87. I was talking to a coworker who said, how old is your dad? And I told him at the time. He said, let him mow the lawn. My dad is like 75 and sits in the armchair all day and watches TV and does nothing. So, and
that's correct. That guy is committing suicide by not moving at all. So the 10,000 steps should not discredit anybody because there is huge evidence that any activity that increases your heart rate is life prolonging and disease preventing.
Well, I know that since I'm now mowing a lawn, and I hadn't been for about 30 years since I was renting, it does take a little bit out of you, but you feel good after doing it and you feel some sense of accomplishment, so I guess that helps.
I would certainly agree.
Now, there's a second question here, and this is from Jim. Living in Michigan, I hope Dr. Merkin has some insight on cyclospora outbreak in our food in the next podcast. There isn't much information available on it. I would point out, Jim, if you listen to last month's podcast, Dr. Merkin talked a great deal about it. But, Dr. Merkin, do you have any updates or any more thoughts about it?
Yeah, a lot of people think that all the lettuce is bad. It's not. This outbreak is shredded lettuce. In other words, you don't buy a head of lettuce. You buy a bag of already cut up lettuce. And that has been shown to be a problem with one company, and the company has denied it, and there's been some problems. But the message really is it was an outbreak that went into a huge number of states, and the outbreak is really in if you live in Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and West Virginia, that's where the outbreak really is. The concern is that some people might be carrying that shredded lettuce or what have you. But Cyclospora is a terrible, terrible parasite. And the message that we give you is that if you suddenly get diarrhea and cramping and everything else, your doctor should realize that it can be cured immediately with a simple antibiotic that's available everywhere. It's called Bactrim. And so since we have a cure, it's very important to know that you get explosive diarrhea and you've eaten shredded lettuce in the last week. You should go to your doctor, and it may be a good idea to take the Bactrim, depending really on how sick you are. If you have a little bit of cramping, you don't know. But if you're sick and you're feeling rotten, you may be better off with the Bactrim than without it because it's a cure.
The biggest problem that I've read in these stories, and I think we talked a little about it last week, was by the time you have developed the symptoms, it's had a time to grab a hold of you, and the Bactrim may do something, but it's not going to do as much as if you got it at the first signs of it. And most people immediately have
There's no debate in the scientific community. If you have cyclospora, you should be given Bactrim because the disease can last a long time and go on and on and on.
Yeah, I've had people talking about, or I've seen people talking about or reading about something like 2 weeks until they feel even remotely better. So this is not just a simple case of food poisoning. This
because
is far beyond.
Terrible diarrhea.
Yeah.
It's a terrible and diarrhea pulls the minerals and the water out of you, and you feel sick, and you've now got to recover from all the side effects of the disease it caused.
There are two other questions that both Ken and Jim asked, and I'll ask them in order. Ken had asked, your e-zine weekly newsletter. One was sent out a few weeks ago, then nothing. What happened? I thought you were going to continue with them. And the other question from Jim was, I'm not sure if I missed it on your podcast, but what happened to Dr. Merkin's AI search on his website? It's not there anymore. You have a whole story to tell about this, don't you?
Yes, I'm 91 years old, and I have slowed down tremendously. I used to be able to write that newsletter in 4 or 5 hours in one evening. I can't do that anymore. If I want to write a newsletter now, I can still write a little newsletter, but it'll take me the whole week. I can't do anything else. So I've decided that it's just too demanding. It takes all of my time to really do it. As far as the questions, we had a section where you could ask any question at all, and the artificial intelligence would answer that question immediately after you put it up on the web. And the problem is that artificial intelligence can make mistakes. And if they do make a mistake, the doctor or the person who has written whatever medical advice is wrong can be sued. And I don't have any malpractice insurance. It's very expensive. And since I'm not practicing medicine anymore, I don't have medical practice insurance. And therefore, it's risky that I don't need to take. So you still have the website. You'll find thousands of articles I've written over 60, 70 years. They all have journal references, so they've all based on the scientific literature. Nothing I've written omits the journal references, so you always can go back to the scientific journals that have published it. So I feel comfortable with that, and I'm going to continue. The website is up. You can get on the website anytime you want. You can't ask the questions for an immediate AI answer.
And you also had a problem where it was down for a while because somebody that you had hired to take care of things decided they just would run off with it and do whatever they wanted with the information on it.
Well, they wanted to monetize it and make money. And I've never done that. In fact, I've never made any money from that website. We found out that when Google puts you on, they pay you for your website. The problem is that you get huge amounts of ads of dishonest products. And there were so many dishonest products that I didn't believe in and they were just fraud that I decided to say, take off your advertising on my website and don't pay me. And I had to pay them. So I had to pay for my website. But by the same token, my conscience was clear. I didn't have these horrendous fraudulent products being sold on the site on my website.
I'm not going to name any specific media companies, but some of them are national known names. Some are old line networks. Some are newer. And some are local media. And I noticed they've got a ton of these skeevy ads on the bottom of the website. On WRTA.com, we don't do that. Any ad that we have is from a local advertiser or something that we are working with them on or promoting, and as a paid promotion or something like that. But we don't have all these ridiculous ads about, ridiculous things you shouldn't have to mention on the radio. Or it'd be better if you didn't, especially right. If there are kids in the car. But, I mean, some of the stuff that is laughably stupid. I see this on other ads, and I'm thinking, well, they're going to be making a pile of money off of it. We make our money from the commercials and the advertisers and the local folks, so we appreciate them and that. So I admire you for doing that, and so people understand the website is back, the AI search is off, and even, you notice, Google, for some reason now, I try to Google something to look up a specific website or a specific company, it'll give me an AI thing before it'll ever let me get to the website. And it says that's right correct. At the bottom, AI might not be all that bright, so, you know, double check. Gee, thanks.
That's right. AI can give you misinformation, even if it's well-meaning. And there's an incredible amount of fraud on the web. I'm telling you that many of these products that you see advertised, especially the products that have an ad that lasts 30 minutes or longer, those are almost always something wrong with them. There's an incredible amount of fraud on the web.
Yeah, if I'm watching YouTube, I want to see the person who's doing the video. I don't want to have to hit skip every 5 minutes because there's something that's going to take me 40 minutes to get rid of otherwise. So that's something to keep in mind, but it's drmirkin.com, drmirkin.com. We'll put the link back on the podcast page. You'll be able to check out the information on there. And I suggest that you look through it because he's got a wealth of information on there, and it is not tainted now that the AI is gone and he's got control back of the website. It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen, the one and only Dr. Gabe Merkin, is with us talking about measles here. Now, on WRTA.com, one of our local stories, Lancaster County is the epicenter for the measles outbreak in Pennsylvania. Health officials say 92 of the 158 reported measles cases in the Commonwealth this year have been traced to Lancaster County. That's almost 60%. The health department says none of the reported cases are fully vaccinated. There's number one. Now, this is from NBC. Measles, one of the most contagious viruses in the world, is regularly infecting people in the U.S. again. And by the way, this has a tracker that you can check where the problems are, where the reported cases of measles are, wherever you are in the United States. And we will put a link to that on the podcast page as well. And NBC continues, already in 2026, more than 2,300 cases have been counted, making this year the 2 year for measles infections in the U.S. since 2000. NBC is continuing to track the confirmed cases, and this is using Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data. Measles case counts reached a 34-year high, and 7 months into 2026, the total is even higher. The disease epicenter has started in South Carolina, where the CDC has confirmed 600-plus measles cases. As late as January, more than 500 people were in quarantine, and over 100 infected in the state. State officials declared South Carolina outbreak over in April. How are we getting to this point again?
This is very, very disturbing. It shows that you should not have the government make rules and people in the government making these rules when they have no real good medical knowledge. They've not shown they can really read the medical literature, or they may not have read the medical literature at all. The truth of the matter is that nobody is born protected from measles. Measles is a terrible germ that can kill. Yes, it can kill people. It can make them very, very sick. We got rid of measles by immunization. If you give a dead virus, or a virus, measles virus, that is downplayed so it can't cause the disease to a person, that person's immunity develops cells and chemicals that can come out immediately in the bloodstream and kill the measles. So we got rid of measles from immunization. Now, we didn't get rid of measles throughout the entire world, but everywhere where we had mass vaccinations, there was no more measles. We weren't seeing any cases. And suddenly we stopped. Well, when you stop immunizing because somebody is telling you that you can be harmed by something, the truth of the matter is the measles immunization worked. They got rid of the measles, period. There's no debate about that. If you look at the literature, it got rid of the measles. But there were some measles, say, in Africa or somewhere else, and those from places that were not massively immunized. And then somebody travels from Africa to the United States and brings one case of measles in. Now you have the virus in America, and you had a population 30 years ago where everybody was immunized. If they got exposed to the measles virus, they got no disease because their immunity went bang and killed it, and it didn't spread and it didn't cause disease. And suddenly people aren't getting immunized. So suddenly a very large percentage of the population has no immunity to measles. So if you bring a measles virus from Europe or Africa or anywhere else to the United States, and you expose people who are not immunized, they're going to get sick. And not only that, they will make more virus, and they'll spread that virus to expose other people. And suddenly you have an epidemic that had disappeared years ago coming back. And that's where we are now. So I strongly recommend that the public get measles immunization, the children get measles immunization, because we might as well have a population that's immune. Otherwise, you're going to have to have no immigration, no travel, where you can't have people come, where you run the risk of somebody bringing that virus back to America.
You know, the thing is, I just checked the CDC website. They still, now some people may say, oh, they recommend you to get rid of a whole bunch of things. They did not recommend you stop with the measles vaccination. The current recommendation is the first dose given at age 12 to 15 months. Second dose, age 4 to 6 years before entry of school. Adults born in 1957 or later need at least one dose two doses recommended for high-risk groups like, as Dr. Merkin said, international travelers, healthcare workers, and college students. Now, where they have changed things slightly is the MMRV combo shot. CDC advisory panel updated guidelines regarding that because that was measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella chickenpox vaccine, MMRV, recommended that children under the age of four receive separate MMR and varicella shots for the first dose to lower the risk of fever-induced seizures. The combination MMRV shot remains an option for children age four and older, according to what the CDC is recommending. Any thoughts on that, Doctor?
Well, yes, but you're seeing people in authority, in executive privilege, saying that you don't need immunization. And that's not true. That runs contrary to everything in the scientific literature. The message is that immunization works. And yes, you can have a reaction to an immunization, but you'll find out that the reaction to immunization is 100,000th or 1,000,000th of reaction to the disease.
In your opinion, now, the CDC is saying there's a combo shot. You can get it if you wish. However, the recommendation, again, is you get four separate vaccinations, maybe not the same day. I'm not sure on the way this is written. Four separate vaccinations, one for measles, one for mumps, one for rubella, and one for varicella, which is chickenpox. Would you say it's better to do four separate or just get the MMRV?
Well, at this point, they've been doing them together for many, many years. It has to be a personal thing. If a person has a question of defect in their immunity, it may want to separate them. But generally, the combination vaccine has been around for many years and has been quite effective.
Well, here's something I was thinking about. I was listening to one of the programs on one of our stations this past weekend, and they were talking about things that happened 37 years ago. And 37 years ago is, believe it or not, 1989, and the people then were going through a spike in measles, just as we are now, because people stopped doing the vaccination. I remember when I was 8 years old, we're talking 1968, there was also a spike in measles and rubella because there was a big campaign. I was growing up in Metro New York, and the thing was they tried to make it as kid-friendly as possible. They would show a cartoon umbrella walking down an actual street, and you hear a kid's voice, "Get your rubella umbrella," meaning get the vaccination. So in other words, they're advertising, although it was public service announcements from the New York State Health Department, advertising to kids, hey, bug your parents to take you to get this vaccination. So if you think about it, 37 years ago and then 68 and who knows before that when these shots first came out, we seem to lower ourselves into a false sense of security, do we not?
Yes, and we have people telling us that immunization is bad. You can't make a broad statement like that. You can have a serious reaction to an immunization. Anything that turns on your immunity can cause an exaggerated reaction. But the message I want to give everybody is the number of serious reactions to the vaccine are 100,000th or 1,000,000th. As frequently as the reaction to the disease. So you're talking about an overwhelming statistical benefit over all of this. And the population gains. And you're doing something for the population. When you get immunized, you're helping to protect everybody else because you're protecting yourself so you won't be a spreader.
Again, just what the CDC says, they do still recommend these vaccinations. Measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella. That's MMRV. However, they have recommended that it might be better that you have your child vaccinated with them at four separate dates, four separate vaccinations. However, the MMRV is still available, and the CDC says if you want that, get that for your kid, but think about doing it the other way. It's up to you to decide, but if anybody tells you, oh, well, the CDC says you don't need a measles. No, they say that you need a measles vaccine. And the other thing is, as far as chickenpox, my mother had the shingles because she had chickenpox as a kid. There were other people that were in her apartment building that also had shingles far worse than she did. And this was before the modern two vaccination treatment for shingles, the Shingrix vaccine. And no, we're not getting any money to mention it, just so you know. But is there a competitor to that, or is it only Shingrix, doctor?
I think there is only Shingrix.
It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen with the one, the only, Dr. Gabe Merkin. One of the things that I'm starting to see in the news is about an Ebola outbreak in the Congo. According to ABC News, what experts are saying about Ebola in Congo, Uganda kills more than 1,000. They tend not to say it's a real threat, but let me go through some of this. The fastest growing Ebola outbreak in history has killed more than 1,000 people in the eastern Congo. An update from the Congo's Public Health Institute said there have been 2,536 confirmed Ebola cases, 1,033 deaths, at least 738 patients in isolation or hospitalized. The outbreak was declared May 15th. It's unlike previous outbreak instances because it's spreading through communities and it has no approved vaccine or treatments. The most concentrated in remote province, which accounts for 90% of cases, but there have been other confirmed in five provinces, including one of the Congo's largest cities. Congolese officials say the sharp rise in cases appears to be slowing. They caution the outbreak has not yet peaked. The latest report by the country's Public Health Institute says transmission remains sustained, with recent fluctuations in cases likely influenced by reporting delays and ongoing data consolidation. Contact tracing continues to lag. Only about 77% of the known monitored cases nationwide, well below the target of 95% that health officials say they need to interrupt transmission. Now, they say the global risk is low, noting Ebola spreads through direct contact with bodily fluids and of an infected person rather than through the air, making it much harder to spread than respiratory viruses. You mentioned international travel earlier, talking about something else. What do you say about this? It's serious, but not something that we have to worry about too much?
Well, we don't have any reported cases that I know of in America, but we're going to have some traveler come from Africa where the epidemic is, and they may bring the virus, and that could have very serious consequences. So the message is that I don't know what you can do. We have not seen any Ebola virus in America that I know of.
All right.
But we have an epidemic in Africa, and we do have people traveling from Africa to America, so that's a concern. And it's body fluids, by the way. You brought that up. It's in saliva. It's in urine. It's in phlegm in your mouth. It's not spread by breathing. It's spread by getting saliva on your arm, and then your arm on your hand, the saliva on your hand, and then touching something, and then somebody touches that. So you can get it from an object, not from another person.
It would also be something like sneezing, spitting, anything like that could also transmit it.
Well, we're not seeing it. It's not like being in a room with somebody with Ebola and they sneeze. It's that the body fluid gets transferred to the person through an object or that person that's sick with the virus.
Okay, moving along to the next story. FDA approves first-of-its-kind cholesterol pill. And this is from Indianapolis. The FDA approved the first one aimed at treating hypercholesterolemia?
High cholesterol.
Okay, we'll just say that, yeah. Merck said in a release, so obviously the company is releasing the information here, said its drug Lipfendra was the first oral inhibitor. High cholesterol is a disorder known for excess of low-density lipoprotein, LDL, or bad cholesterol in the blood, which can build up plaque in the arteries. About 1 out of 20 people have this, according to the Cleveland Clinic. High cholesterol can be caused by genetic disorder or lifestyle factors like a diet high in saturated and trans fats and other health factors. This is a pivotal moment that we bring the first USDA-approved PCSK9 inhibitor to adults with high LDL-C, offering patients an important new option. It works by blocking the protein, which helps regulate cholesterol levels. Trials showed that a once-daily pill significantly lowered LDL cholesterol in patients. While there are already injectables, this is the first pill. The ongoing study will look at cardiovascular morbidity and mortality. Doctor, what do you think?
Well, we already have the an injectable chemical. Mm-hmm. This is the first one that's the same as the injectable medicine to lower cholesterol, but you can take it as a pill now. So that's a step forward because a lot of people don't like injections and they feel they're safer as a pill. The incredible thing is, you should hear this. Everybody should hear what 50% of all the deaths in America are due to heart attacks. And heart attacks are associated with high cholesterol. In fact, for years until just recently, we used to, most of the treatment was to get the bad, harmful blood LDL cholesterol below 100. That used to be the treat. We still say that if your cholesterol is over 100, you should certainly change your lifestyle. You're a bad cholesterol, LDL. Get it on. But now, because of these new drugs, the new guideline is 50. This is incredible. That if anybody's had a heart attack, the doctors are now using this new drug, because you could, statins don't get the bad cholesterol down below 50 in some people. So we now have a new drug that gets the bad cholesterol down to very low levels. And the new rule, instead of 100, they want you under 55. And the rule is now that if you've got a heart attack, you must get your LDL bad cholesterol down below 55. Well, you can't do that without this new drug. This new drug is the one that's getting it for most people down. So this is a very significant breakthrough. And the new rule that we're learning from all the recent research, and this is a shocker, you know there's a good cholesterol and a bad cholesterol. The LDL is lousy, so it's bad. The HDL is healthy, so it's good. Well, we know the LDL is bad. And we used to say 100, I told you, and now we're saying getting below 50 for people with heart attack. Do you know that if you have an LDL of 2, you'd be better off if you had of 1? In other words, the lower the bad LDL cholesterol, the better. There's no argument about that in preventing disease. The problem is that cholesterol has a tremendous amount of beneficial effects on human beings. Cholesterol measures all your hormones. Did you know that? That vitamin D comes from cholesterol. That many of your cortisone and your cortisols and your other hormones that are necessary to be healthy come from cholesterol. So now we're hearing that you should get the bad LDL, and that's what everybody should do. Get a blood test for cholesterol, and you'll find your LDL. And you definitely want, even if you're healthy and have nothing wrong, you want your LDL below 100. Try and do it with lifestyle changes. If you can, get it down under 100, you're a candidate for statins. And if you've had a heart attack, you're probably going to need this new drug, because this new drug gets it down below 50, and that makes a very significant drop in your susceptibility to dying. So it's saving lives. Now, you'll say, is there any problem with getting your cholesterol too low? Well, we don't know yet, but we think it might, because I told you that cholesterol does a lot of good things. It's a pre-hormone for a lot of other hormones in your body. It's a pre-hormone for vitamins in your body. So if you get it too low, you may lower your vitamin D or your cortisol or your insulin or other things that could be harmful.
Well, while you were talking about that, I'm sitting there taking all this in. I figured, oh, I can look this up on my phone to see where I am on this. The LDL is 103, and it's been higher in years ago, so I've been slowly getting it down lower and lower and lower, but it's 103. The good cholesterol is 38, which they said, oh, that's fine, don't worry about it. And they said also on last year's results that 103, oh, that's fine, that's within normal parameters. So I guess they're moving the goalposts.
Now, yes, the current recommendation is if your LDL is over 100 and you are healthy, you don't have to take drugs, but you sure as the devil should be doing lifestyle. And everybody should know lifestyle that lowers cholesterol, prolongs life. Everything I'm going to mention now prolongs lives and prevents multiple diseases, heart attacks, cancers, strokes, premature death, just about everything bad. One, we know you have to be more active. Two, avoid tobacco. Three, avoid alcohol. There is no amount of safe alcohol. All alcohol is harmful. Four, get enough sleep, because lack of sleep is a risk factor for premature death. A healthy diet. You know about cutting out mammal meat. You should be severely restricting mammal meat. Sugar-added foods. Sugar-added drinks, fried foods should be severely restricted. You should be eating a plant-based diet, because soluble fiber in all plants and no living, moving animals. Soluble fibers in all plants, and soluble fiber lowers LDL by itself. Soluble fiber lowers inflammation, which causes heart attacks and cancers. Soluble fiber does only good things. So the current recommendation is, if you're trying to lose weight, load up on plants and start restricting other things. And you, of course, you have to control blood pressure, blood cholesterol, blood sugar, and body weight. And that's the list that everybody should be doing, even those people that think they're protected, because we're seeing heart attacks. 50% of all people are dying of heart attacks, basically. So all of the rules I've given you will help prolong your life.
Well, it's interesting, because over the years, I've certainly eat a lot less fried foods. And I mean, we all look, there's a reason deep fried foods taste so well. But it's not a not something you should be eating a great deal of. My friend who had to get a stent a couple of summers ago, he's not allowed to eat that stuff anymore, so he doesn't. It's funny, I went on vacation. Not only did I not have a drink, because usually I have one drink, but I figured an alcoholic drink. I'm not going to, because I'm not driving, I don't have to worry about that, and we're having a big dinner. I decided, it's not really worth the amount of sugar. The funny thing is, I come back from vacation. Okay, how much weight did I put on? Oh, I lost 4 pounds? Okay, considering we were eating out, but we were eating a little more healthy this year. I guess that has something to do with it.
Well, I can't overemphasize how important diet really is. And now the literature is eating fresh foods, not prepared foods, because manufacturers add preservatives, and some of which are poison. They're adding all kinds of chemicals for coloring. There's all kinds of harmful chemicals which are coming up. So now we want you to eat food that you're buying, all fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, seeds, and nuts, and we're getting things in packages may be risky, because foods that are in packages have all kinds of additives behind you, and they're unbalanced. But there's now literature that the more packaged foods you eat, the refined foods, the more you eat, the more likely you are to increase your risk for heart attacks and cancers and premature death. We're asking you to have food that's coming in the vegetable and fruit counter and nut counter and seed counter and unground whole grain counter, rather than what you find in a bag or a package.
It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen, Dr. Gabe Merkin. The website is back, drmirkin.com, so you can check that out. And there'll also be a podcast of this program up at WRTA.com at the end of the program. Next story here. Being a night owl may not be great for your heart, but you can do something about it. This is of interest to me, since I am a night owl. From the Associated Press, it may sound surprising, but a large study found that people who are active late at night, when most people in the population is winding down or already asleep, have poorer overall heart health than the average person. It's not like that night owls are doomed, said the researcher at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, who led the study. The challenge is the mismatch between your internal clock and the typical daily schedules. It makes it harder to follow heart-healthy behaviors, and that's fixable. He describes himself, the doctor, as sort of a night owl, and he feels that my analytical thinking is best after 7 or 8 at night. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the U.S. The American Heart Association has a list of 8 key factors that everybody should heed for better healthy living, being more physically active. Well, this sounds like something Dr. Merkin would say, and he's been saying it for years, being physically more active, avoiding tobacco, getting enough sleep and a healthy diet, controlling blood pressure, cholesterol, blood sugar, and weight. Where does being a night owl come in? That has to do with the body's circadian rhythm, our master biological clock. It follows a roughly 24-hour schedule that regulates not just when we become sleepy and when we're more awake, but also keeps organ systems in sync, influencing things like heart rate, blood pressure, stress hormones, and metabolism. Everybody's circadian rhythm is a little bit different. Prior research has suggested night owls might have more health problems, as well as risk factors like high rates of smoking and less physical activity than people with typical bedtimes. They track 300,000 middle-aged or older adults in the UK. It's a huge database that includes information about people's sleep preferences. About 8% of those people classify themselves as night owls, more active physically and mentally in late afternoon or evening, or up past most people's bedtime. About a quarter were early birds, most productive in the daylight hours and otherwise, likewise early to bed. The results were averaged somewhere in the middle. Over 14 years, the night owls had a 16% higher risk of a first heart attack or stroke compared to the average population. The night owls, especially women, also had overall worse cardiovascular health based on meeting the Heart Association's 8 key factors. Unhealthy behaviors, like the smoking, insufficient sleep, poor diet, appear to be the main reasons. What do you think, Dr. Merkin?
I think that's very interesting and good research, and people should pay attention. If you look at the data that we've known for more than 100 years, we've known that as the day goes along into the night, you start out in the morning, and as the day goes along, your blood pressure goes down. In other words, your blood pressure is usually lower. In a healthy person, blood pressure is lower in the evening than it is in the morning. We also know that heart rate is slower in the evening than it is in the morning. We know that people who are night owls have the reverse. In other words, their circadian rhythm, the normal body rhythm where the blood pressure and the heart rate go down as you get into the evening, these night owls, their blood pressure goes up. And now we have a really well-done study that shows that people who are night owls are dying earlier and getting more heart attacks than people who are daytime owls. And they, the authors classified, you mentioned this, that 25% of people are early birds. They're most active in the morning, and then they slow down as they get in the evening. And 8% of the population are night owls. And the night owls, the ones whose blood pressure goes up as the day goes on, whose pulse rate goes up as the day goes on, who do their activities at night, are much more active in the evening, those are the ones that are at increased risk for premature death and heart attacks. So we're having a message that you should be eating your biggest food in the morning, because that's when you're most active and you're capable of clearing your blood sugar faster and processing your food than in the evening. When you do in the evening, your blood sugar is rising higher after you eat, and you're not clearing your food as fast as you would in the morning. And you should try and be a daytime person and slow down at night. But the problem is the circadian rhythm, the body regulation system, is being thrown off by in people who are most active at night.
Could it be also, though, I know some people who worked in radio. I used to do morning radio for 9 years, and for whatever reason, I was able to do it. I was able to get out of bed in the morning, get to work, get to be on the radio because I'm interested in that. I enjoy being on the radio. I enjoy doing this as a job. So I would do that first thing in the morning as far as my business, and then I would finish up other things that had to do, you know, associated work that came along with it, and then I would go home. And at that time, it was easier for me to get to sleep early because I was spent, I was tired. Now that I'm not doing that, I do sleep in a little bit more than some people do, unless I have to get up and take care of something, you know, get the car fixed or whatever. And I notice I don't have too much of a problem with that. And I do still feel some days I'm more awake at 2 in the morning than I am at 2 in the afternoon, although I can function at 2 in the afternoon. Are some people just on their circadian rhythm where they are always going to be night owls and other people are going to be early birds? And you can try to change it, but you're fighting against their nature.
Well, I think you can change it, but that's not completely settled, and there may be people who can't change it. But one of the most important things you can do is exercise during the day. Because if you haven't exercised during the day, you're at increased risk of having too much energy at night. And you should be. I mean, exercise is incredibly important for treating night owls. A regular daily exercise program. And the other interesting thing in this study was that the people who are night owls were more likely to smoke tobacco, were less likely to have a healthy diet.
Yeah, I suppose you live that way, yeah, you can be unhealthy or healthy. The time doesn't matter as much. But if more people are because of, I guess, either being tired or stressed or whatever, or it's like they have nothing to occupy them, maybe they're doom scrolling on their phones now, and smoking will go down because of that. I really don't know. Since I don't smoke, it's not been a problem for me. So I've never had a fight to quit something like that. I've seen other people, it's not easy.
The problem is they didn't exercise during the day, so here they have some extra energy at night, and at night is for sleep.
Well, let me ask you this. If you are working a job where you are going to be a night owl, and there are a lot of people on the night shift, is it better if you get up, whatever time you do get up, later than most, do the exercise first, then go to work? Or is it better if you go to work, whatever hours you are, and then when you get off work, you do the exercise and go to bed?
I don't know of any research that will answer that question. All I can say is that avoiding exercise is going to increase your risk for premature death. And you don't have to exercise. You just have to be active. Do you know that you can commit suicide just by lying in bed and not moving? And in 2 years, you'll die of heart failure. And this is a fascinating fact, that your skeletal muscles strengthen your heart muscle. It's not the other way around. Every time you contract any skeletal muscle, you squeeze the veins next to the muscle. That sends an increased amount of blood flow back to the heart. The increased flow of blood back to the heart stretches the heart muscle, and the heart muscle responds by beating faster with more force, which is how you strengthen your heart muscle. So any kind of active movement increases your heart strength. If you lie in bed and don't move, your heart muscle becomes progressive. Not only your skeletal muscles become weaker, but your heart muscle also becomes weaker because of the mechanism I described. And it can become so weak that you go into failure. Your heart can't circulate enough oxygen, blood oxygen. You don't have enough oxygen in your brain, and you die prematurely. So you have to move. And there are huge studies, several huge studies, where they showed that the people who move more, just put a heart rate monitor on the people every 5 years for 20 years. So they do that four times over 20 years. And they find the people who have pickups in their heart rate by mowing their own lawn, washing their own dishes, and so those are the people who are less likely to get heart attack and to live longer. So you have to be active. You can't be completely inactive. And this has nothing to do with people awake at night. You can increase your rate of sleep and getting good night's sleep, which is very important, by just being more active during the day.
We have to leave it there because we're out of time. But again, the website is back, drmirkin.com. Dr. Gabe Merkin, podcast up in just a few minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.